Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Joe Zimmel and Valerie Friedman.
The other night I took a ride with little old Lucy Brown. We went to all the honky-tonks, we really got around. She's 5'2" with eyes of blue and pretty as a queen. I didn't know her pop was a city cop, and she was just 15. Good morning, Judge. Why do you look so mean, sir? And Mr. Judge, what can the charges be?
I'm not sure that all the jurisprudence spelled out in that song is strictly accurate, but it certainly maybe sums up a little bit of the attitude in America today as the Trump trial begins. We're not going to focus so much on the trial as we are on the jury selection process, on the nature of juries in general. We're going to talk about them several different ways on the show today. We're going to start out with, and I just have to say, that when we first proposed this idea, I said to the producer, Lily Tyson, well, it'd be great if we could get Renato Mariotti. See, I'm stuttering. I'm so starstruck. I'm tumbling over his name. Renato Mariotti, who's on a podcast I like very much. It's with our old friend Asha Rangappa. They host a podcast called It's Complicated. In the rest of his life, he's a trial lawyer and partner at the law firm of Brian Cave, Leighton Paisner, former federal prosecutor. Renato Mariotti, welcome to our show.
Happy to be here.
Big fan of the podcast. So you have operated on both sides of these questions. You've seen a lot of juries impaneled. This trial is not like any other trial in a lot of different ways. But has the jury selection process struck you in any way as especially different?
Yes, I think a couple things. I mean, I guess one at a broad level, I think that jury was seated sooner than I anticipated. So that's the first thing. I thought it was going to take more time. I thought that Trump's team would try to drag things out a little bit. Speaking as somebody who's tried a lot of cases and is a sort of a trial tactician, I think they blew their strikes too early. the defense did. I think on the defense side, you know, your better move is to sort of accept some, you know, you had subpar jurors early, or, you know, just okay, anyone you could live with early, and goad the government into wasting a strike so then you can get some of your perfect jurors towards the end. They ran out of strikes, I think, before the government, which was a mistake. And then the other thing that I think is very interesting or notable is that there are two lawyers in the jury. Very unusual. And I think that may hurt the prosecution here.
Okay, so let's back up for a second, because maybe not everybody understands the system that you were talking about in the first part of your answer. So you get, if you're defense or prosecution, a fixed number of what are called peremptory strikes. You can have a juror dismissed without having to explain why. You can have other jurors dismissed for cause, because there's a specific reason that's agreed upon by the court as a reason to get rid of that particular juror. Am I explaining that fairly well?
Yeah, you are. I think that's right. So essentially, the judge is going to ask a whole slew of background questions. And those questions are going to be used by the judge to potentially screen out people who may not be fair to one side or the other. The lawyers also can make, as you suggested, a motion to dismiss a juror for cause or potential juror for cause. They have an unlimited ability to do that.
So,
but if somebody can't be fair, the only way to get them out is to use those strikes.
Okay, so let me just walk you through a little bit of one of the jurors, and because I think your comments on the process would be helpful to people to understand this. So one of the things that's happened is that I think both sides have kind of fly-specked the social media posts of potential jurors. And so one woman was she was a prospective juror. She was asked to read aloud in the court, in front of Trump, some of the things that she had posted about him over the years on social media. She seemed not to remember posting them. But one of them, because this is a New York jury, so they're going to say New York things, but she had apparently written, "I wouldn't believe him if his tongue were notarized." And after she got through reading her various tweets or whatever they were, she kind of apologized to Trump. And she said, you know, that wasn't exactly how she feels. And she qualified some of her stuff. And she was going to be dismissed for cause. And then she was sent out of the room. And Judge Merchant said that this is actually kind of a close thing for him, that he could find that she's credible. She apologized to Trump. She seemed thoughtful about it. And nonetheless, obviously, the prosecution wanted to get rid of him. And then it's up to Merchant. I think that's sort of an important point, Renato, that in this situation, Judge Merchant then says, okay, yeah, you can dismiss for cause. That kind of, you know, fits the formula. I mean, the judge has a certain amount of power here.
A lot of power. I mean, it's a point that I've made. You mentioned my podcast, It's Complicated. It's a point I make a lot in the context of discussing other trials, because people, you know, scratch their heads at what's going on, let's say, in Florida in the documents case with Judge Cannon or with Judge Chutkan in D.C. The reality is the judge has an extraordinary amount of power, which is why Trump's attacks on the judge are a questionable legal strategy. I mean, maybe they work from a PR or press or political perspective. But yes, the judge has all the power in the courtroom. They have very broad discretion. The prosecution was wise to ask for that juror to be stricken for cause, because that's the sort of thing that could potentially either create an appellate issue or create a perception that the jury was unfair, just unnecessary. So I think the prosecution did the right thing there. But one thing I will just say, you know, reacting to what you're saying, is that I think that people have this misperception that in a jury, in a case, you have to pick 12 people who have never heard anything about the companies or people in question, and secondly, have no opinions about them whatsoever. That is not the standard. The standard is whether or not the person can be fair and render a judgment based on the evidence in the case, the testimony and the exhibits. That's the standard. Very different.
Yeah, and maybe you could talk a little bit about the role of counsel in that situation. So let's say that I'm a prospective juror, and it turns out I've read The Art of the Deal, or I've posted a few things about Trump, or I just admit that I've had some opinions about him in the past. But I say, I firmly believe I can be a fair and impartial juror in this case. If you're counsel for the defense, or maybe prosecution, you have to make kind of a split second decision, don't you, about whether I'm telling the truth. Am I accurate in my portrayal of myself as a person who's able to set aside some of the things I might have said or thought in the past and come to a fair and impartial decision? That's still kind of an instinct call for you, right?
It's actually a more complex call than I think you're even giving it credit for. In other words, I have to make a decision as a lawyer in that situation on either side. Do I want more questioning, whether it's via the judge or myself directly of this witness, and try to develop testimony that will get this person knocked off for cause, even if doing so might give that juror, who might be seated anyway, the impression that I don't like them or I'm against them? In other words, even if I'm not the one asking the questions, even if the judge is the one asking the questions, If let's say I'm defending in this hypothetical scenario, Donald Trump, and all these questions are being asked about their ability to be fair, they're going to realize that this is a concern and that the defense may be concerned about him, or they may impute that to me and then make it on the jury anyway. So you have to be really, and it's certainly a bigger issue when you're the one asking the questions, which some courtrooms you do. So that it's often a very challenging exercise. In trials are very much about EQ as much as IQ. People who are very rational and logical, and that's how they think about things, they usually aren't as good at trial lawyers.
So, you know, you talked about the two lawyers who were on the jury. And one thing that I think might surprise some people who don't follow this kind of thing is that the lawyers in the case, defense and prosecutor, have an opportunity to kind of almost make a little statement or a little argument about the theory of the case to the jury pool before these jurors are impaneled. So in other words, one thing that's a big issue in this case is what's called accessorial liability, the fact that you don't necessarily have to have done a thing to be an accessory to it. And I think Prosecutor Steinglass at one point used the analogy of a hitman, hiring a hitman, which I don't think the defense liked very much. But to that point, it is interesting that the two sides, even talking to people who haven't been impaneled yet, are already making arguments.
Well, that's right. You're from the moment you step into the courtroom, you're putting on a show. Trying a case is like putting on a play. Okay, you the witnesses are different actors, and you line them up in certain ways. You use your opening statements, closing arguments to tell a story. But every minute you're in front of the jury, you're telling a story. Not just by what you say, but who's at your table. Okay, so how many lawyers do I have versus the other side? How are we dressed? How are we acting? You know, I had made a point on a tweet about how Trump didn't stand for the jury. Mm-hmm. Like, little things like that can have a huge impact on the jury. So the jury is watching you and often makes decisions subconsciously based on a whole variety of factors. So it is very important to take every opportunity possible when you can say anything to the jury, to be very thoughtful about what that is.
Yeah, we should just sort of say that the formality is that the lawyers and the defendants stand and turn to face the jury pool. And for whatever reason, Trump decided not to do that, which seemed like maybe not the best idea. Although, could we just say one more thing about that, Renato, which is, you know, my sense is, I'm not some big expert about this, but my guess is if you have even a hardened criminal, like a mobster or something, for a defendant, lawyers just say, don't talk to the judge about the judge. Don't say things about the judge, you know, on social media or into microphones when you're not in the courtroom. Don't bring up the members of the family of the judge and the prosecutor. I mean, Trump is doing stuff that really scary criminals wouldn't do. And it's such a challenge, I think, for Mershon to figure out, you know, what are we going to do about that at the level of contempt of court? And you wonder how that's affecting the jurors, too.
Well, that's right. I mean, for most people, in other words, for most people, being indicted and going through a criminal trial is a life-altering experience. I've had clients, even before they were indicted, who were contemplating suicide. I've had clients for whom it's, you know, resulted in the end of their marriage. I've had clients for whom it's destroyed their business. It can be an all-consuming thing. And being there in that trial, the immense pressure that someone feels can be unbelievable and overwhelming. So for most people, they are very focused on doing everything possible to avoid the worst possible fate, okay, and becoming a convicted felon, facing potential punishment, and so on. Trump has a different attitude towards this. I think he feels that he has to, given all that he's facing. I think it's notable that there have been some reporters who've talked about the psychological impact this has had on Trump. You know, some people have been like, well, that's humanizing him. I don't think so at all. I think it is important for the public to understand that the criminal justice system, this is not a game. This is not a TV show. This is not your of true crime podcast. This is someone's life. This person happens to be Trump. But in this case, you know, Trump, he's facing so many battles on so many fronts, and his only way out is to become president. So he has to subsume his activity here into his disinformation campaign to try to win for president. I think that's the only way to explain how he's acting here.
So there's a little bit of a cat and mouse game, or maybe a big cat and mouse game, going on between the two sides when they're impaneling a jury. And one thing that you've talked about a little bit is, what's a win for the defense? And one of the ways the defense could sort of quote unquote win would have to the somewhat complicated theory that elevates the falsification of records charge to a felony. Have the jury kind of not buy that theory, knock it back down to a misdemeanor. That's pretty much clearly a win for Trump. And the other way to win is a hung jury, which isn't always everybody's idea of a win, but we have to assume probably that the defense would be okay with that.
Yeah. So first of all, a hung jury is an absolute win. Anytime you have a hung jury in the defense, it's an absolute win. One thing I will say is, even though there technically is something called the presumption of innocence, and also something called the burden of proof, proof beyond a reasonable doubt. The fact of the matter is that jurors, unfortunately, in my opinion, unfortunately, often enter a criminal trial with the presumption that the person indicted is guilty. They want to side with the prosecutor. It is harder than people realize to get a defense verdict. And I say this as someone who has defeated the Justice Department at trial. It is hard. And so realistically, on the defense side, hung jury is viewed widely in the defense community as a win. Now, does that necessarily get someone off the hook? No. I actually was at the U.S. Attorney's Office in Chicago when we indicted and tried Rod Blagojevich. And the first trial, there was a hung jury on all but one count. You know, he was retried and then, he convicted on many, many counts. So it doesn't necessarily get you off the hook, but it's definitely considered a victory. I think a much bigger issue for the prosecution, though, particularly given that there are lawyers on the case in the jury pool, is a potentially a lesser included charge here, the misdemeanor, saying, look, there was a falsification of business records, but he was doing it to hide this from political embarrassment, not because he didn't want all the press, not because he was trying to further some other crime or conceal another crime.
You know, when you're impaneling a jury, once again, there's a lot of guesswork. And just for example, there was a juror who said that he had served on a jury before where there was a hung jury and it was declared a mistrial. And so if you're the defense, you're thinking, maybe we want this guy because he's already done a hung jury once before. On the other hand, it could be that he regards that as kind of an article of shame. It shouldn't have happened. He might be very determined this time to make sure there isn't a hung jury. And that must be frustrating, right? You don't really know what's going to happen once the doors close and the jury starts deliberating.
So jury selection is one area of life that is flipped 180 degrees from the way that we usually are as human beings. Usually, we try to train ourselves not to make assumptions about people based on very limited information, not to leap to conclusions based on, you know, who they are, how they present themselves, what they look like, very limited words that they say. Jury selection is totally the opposite of that. You have extraordinarily limited information about somebody, and you have to make a gut judgment about whether or not this person is good or bad for your client, let's just say, or good or bad for the prosecution on either side. It's challenging. And as a prosecutor, I would not want somebody who has been in a jury that hung. In fact, that's a common question is, did you reach a verdict in that prior jury? And if they haven't, I mean, that's something you generally don't want as a prosecution because it means that it's in the forefront of that person's mind that that's an outcome. And yes, it's possible that they hate that and they were on the side that was trying to stop the hanging of that jury, but you don't know. And, you know, for the prosecution side, usually when you bring a case, you're so confident in the evidence that you just need people who will see what's there and just go along with the crowd and go with the obvious, okay? And that's usually what you're looking for as prosecutors. So anyone outside the box, you usually want to strike.
A point I heard you make the other day is this, that obviously, both sides put as much effort as they possibly can and think very hard about all these questions and sometimes do social media research. But juries do weird things once they get in the room, things that aren't even all that logically explained. I think you gave an example of a case that you did where the jury found the defendant guilty on certain counts and not on other counts, although all the counts kind of amounted to the same thing. But could you talk a little bit about that, how juries don't always do a thing that you could logically predict?
Sure. I mean, in fact, there's a lot of litigation over that because there's a question of, well, if this jury verdict is totally illogical or internally inconsistent, can we still uphold it? And I'll just tell you that it shouldn't come as a surprise to everyone that courts are very deferential to a jury verdict because they don't want to retry cases. Judges have the judicial system, it's a massive amount of resources to try a case. And for a judge to retry a multi-month case or multi-week case It's just a tremendous amount of resources. So typically what happens is these verdicts are read in the light most favorable to being upheld. And it is often the case that jurors, will reach some sort of compromise. I mean, one thing that I'm always thinking about, what I thought about when I was a prosecutor, and I think about it even more on the defense side, is where's the compromise here? In other words, something that prosecutors will do is load up the indictment with 30, 40 counts for, you know, there's ways to make one crime like a many, many counts. And they'll do it that way because it's hard for the jury to check no or not guilty 30 something times. And it allows for a compromise where maybe there's, one holdout who thinks that the guy's guilty or not guilty or whatever. And then they just come up with something that finds the defendant guilty on a few felonies, but not on all the rest. But of course, the prosecutor and the defense both know, the jury doesn't, that being convicted on 2 out of 30 counts still means you're a convicted felon. It's still a win for the prosecution. You know, sometimes when you are on the defense side, you're trying to figure out what is a middle ground I can give the jury that would be good for my client. There are times when I've argued against, when I've been confident and I've argued against a compromise. Like, for example, I had a case where I defeated the Justice Department, where in my closing argument, I told the jury, if he's convicted on any count, even one count, it will destroy his life. Basically, this guy will be a convicted felon. He is not guilty at any one of these counts. At any one of these counts will devastate his life. And I did that purposely because I was concerned about an illogical compromise.
Yeah, it's a great point that, in some ways the defense has a numerical advantage in that to get a hung jury, they just need one juror to refuse to go along with a conviction. But the prosecution, as you just illustrated, has an advantage. If there's, I think, 34 counts in this case, they don't have to get a guilty verdict on 34 counts. They need, as you just said, one or two, which does give them a certain numerical advantage, right?
Absolutely. I mean, the prosecution has a lot of advantages. Okay. On paper, we can describe the system in a way that is beneficial to the defense because there are a lot of constitutional protections that are built in for the defense, right? The defendant doesn't have to testify. The government has the burden of proof and so on. But in practice, the government, because they're the ones who write the indictment, and there's a presumption in a lot of citizens' mind that they're the white hat, so to speak. It can be very, very challenging for the defense, and it's why so many cases result in a guilty plea.
Okay, we're going to stop there. Our guest is a busy person. Renato Mariotti is a trial attorney and partner at the law firm Brian Cave Leighton Paisner. He's a former federal prosecutor and host of, and really check this out, people, the It's Complicated podcast. Renato Mariotti, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. Loneliness can be a significant health risk to people of all ages. Dr. Laura Saunders, a psychologist from Hartford HealthCare's Institute of Living, talks about social isolation and why we need to connect in person.
Loneliness actually is a pretty significant health risk for people that struggle with social isolation. It affects their blood pressure, it affects their immune system, it affects your willingness to get up and get out, and can cause some not just emotional issues, but health problems as well.
You're not alone. Dr. Saunders explains how important it is for us to look to others and get out of our comfort zone.
I like to talk about social isolation as not just that individual's problem, but it's a community problem or it's a family problem. We need to connect with others. We can take space at times as well, but we need to step out of our comfort zone and do things to connect with other people. It's life-saving.
For more information, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
Yes, a lot of our information about the criminal justice system, and I guess I use information with quotes around it, a lot of that information comes from the TV shows we watch, the movies we watch. most of that information is about investigations, about prosecutions, about the work of defense counsel. Jurors and juries, not so much. I'm going to talk about that right now with Nancy Martyr, professor of law, director of the Justice of, John Paul Stevens Jury Center, co-director of the Institute for Law and the Humanities at the Chicago Kent College of Law at Illinois Tech. She's the author of The Power of the Jury, Transforming Citizens into Jurors. Nancy Martyr, welcome to our conversation.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So, in a way, I think one argument you make is that there's, in the world of popular culture, kind of one really good depiction of how juries can operate, and then the quality falls off rather steeply from there. Before I have you talk about it, let's hear a clip from that one good example. This is from 12 Angry Men, and we'll hear a little clip here. B1 Maestro.
This fighting, that's not why we are here, to fight. We have a responsibility. This, I have always thought, is a remarkable thing about democracy, that we are, what is the word, notified, that we are notified by mail to come down to this place to decide on the guilt or innocence of a man we have never heard of before. We have nothing to gain or lose by our verdict. This is one of the reasons why we are strong. We should not make it a personal thing.
So it's 1957, and the movie is just this all-star team of male character actors from that era. I mean, kind of everybody's on it. Martin Balsam, John Fiedler, Lee J. Cobb, Jack Warner, Jack Warden, who am I leaving out? Ed Begley Sr. So, Nancy, talk about this one. It really does kind of stand out in the pack.
It really does. It's an amazing movie. And even though it's black and white, made in 1957, I think it reveals a lot about juries and jury deliberations. And even though academics disagree about, you know, whether this really reflects what an actual jury does, I think it comes closest to showing how sides can form very quickly. Most people want to get done with their jury work, but it's only through the example of Henry Fonda, who plays juror number 8, who has some reservation because everyone just wants to vote and be done with it. And he manages to slow things down and make his fellow jurors think about and talk about the evidence and to follow the instructions and to maintain the presumption of innocence. And so even though there are a lot of things that go wrong with this deliberation, you have one juror who's prejudiced and another juror who has a personal connection to that relates to the case in a sense because there's a young defendant who killed his father or might have. And so in a lot of ways, this is not a perfect jury deliberation. And yet it shows how jurors come to understand their role, even jurors who didn't from the very beginning, but ultimately they do. And I think that transformation is very important to see.
It really is a remarkable thing. And yes, they're kind of led in a different direction ultimately by this one juror played by Henry Fonda. I hadn't known this prior to getting ready for this show, but I guess there are international versions of this now that other countries are making this movie, probably in a way that reflects certain particularities of their own systems. But tell us about that.
Yes, that's really an amazing development. So this movie, when it came out, by the way, was a box office failure. And the fact that it managed to exist and endure all these years is really quite amazing. And now it has a world following. There's a Chinese version, a Russian version. There are versions. There's one from Lebanon. And then, of course, from Western democracies. But even systems that don't have democracies and don't have juries have remade this movie. And so it's being remade in the country's own language or some of the languages. And so it's reaching a worldwide audience. And I just find that amazing.
So is it true that you feel as though there isn't much that rivals it in terms of a useful or, useful depiction of a jury?
I would say there is a dearth of jury movies otherwise. In fact, I would say they're really quite poor, and they really do function just as a vehicle for entertainment. But I will say that there's one theme that usually connects all of them, which is they depict a hung jury or a holdout juror. And the reason they often do this is that's where the drama is. That's where the story is. But in fact, hung juries are very uncommon. And so it doesn't reflect how the jury system works. It just reflects how we depict the jury system in movies.
You know, John Grisham, the writer, seems interested in, he writes legal thrillers. He seems interested in juries. Two of his books actually have some version of that word in the title, The Last Juror and The Runaway Jury, which got made into a movie. And the Runaway Jury, at least, and you may feel free to contradict me, we'll play a little clip from it. But in it, Gene Hackman plays a kind of ruthless and elite jury consultant, and he's kind of the new model where in real time, in some remote boiler room, they're analyzing pictures and digging around on the web and coming up with theories. And so we'll hear a little clip. They're talking about a juror, I believe, in this clip, played by John Cusack, who in fact is kind of a wild card juror. And you're hearing, I think, advice from the boiler room there. This would be B3, Maestro.
So he's lying. Where's he from?
Moved here 8 months ago. Trails cold.
Just dropped out of the sky like the Archangel Gabriel, huh?
You put him on a jury with Sergeant Herrera, he's going to be doing dog tricks inside 5 minutes.
Look, without reviewing his questionnaire, without a formal Q&A, I don't think I can trust this.
Well, you're only lead counsel for the defense, Mr. Cable. You shouldn't pretend to know very much about jury selection. Nicholas Easter, he's an entertainer. Wants to make everybody happy. Not a bad way to go through life, making everybody happy. But in court, it's not that simple. Somebody always loses. Just not me. He's a risk. Let's move on.
Somebody always loses. Just not me. So that's very Grishamy dialogue. I don't know whether you find this movie particularly useful or not, but we kind of are in a new age of jury selection and what jury consultants can do just using digital stuff. There's even jury consultants now who use facial recognition software to try to monitor emotional changes in the jury over the course of the trial when they can do that. Maybe there's some worth in highlighting that for people.
I'm very skeptical about jury consultants because I think what people cannot do very well is figure out group dynamics. And so you might know things about individual jurors, but you don't know how they're going to work with each other. And we're very bad at predicting that. And so, yes, there's a lot more that people can find out with social media, but I don't think they really manage to do this. And the other thing, which I think is really important, is it's not just about demographic background characteristics. In fact, it's not about that at all, really. It's really about the individual jurors' understanding or conception of their role as juror and how they understand it over the course of the trial, and then how they work together as a group. And a jury consultant cannot really get at that. And a focus on individual characteristics or background demographic characteristics of a individual juror does not get at that either. So I'm resistant on both those fronts.
You know, Nancy, one of the other things that happens in popular culture, particularly in comedy settings, comedy is derived from the efforts of people to get out of jury duty. This is probably most memorably done in the series 30 Rock, although Homer Simpson maybe comes in a close second. So Liz Lemon tries to get out of jury duty, and one of her techniques is to show up. in the jury pool dressed as Princess Leia from Star Wars. This is B2, Maestro.
Excuse me, Imperial Guard. How long do these arson trials typically last?
A couple weeks, probably.
You can drop the voice.
Oh, this used to get me out of jury duty in Chicago all the time.
This ain't Chicago, honey. Look at these people.
And the guard bailiff gesticulates towards a jury pool full of all kinds of incredible weirdos and misfits. And, you know, it's very funny, but in a way, maybe the wrong message we should be sending. This is a pretty important part of our society, Nancy, and, you know, you kind of should want to do it.
It is true that in popular culture, the way that jury duty is greeted is like root canal or something akin to that. And the question is, how do you change that attitude? And the good thing is that even though everyone or most people are not happy when they get that jury summons, from the time they appear in the courtroom, while they initially might want to get off of jury duty, and hence the humor in the TV programs, what happens is they start to take it very seriously, very quickly. And you can almost see this during the voir dire, the questioning of prospective jurors. And I've sat in many jury selection trials and during jury selection. And the people initially think about what can they do to get off the jury. And then you can almost watch as they hear, other people say, yes, I can be impartial. I think they start to ask themselves, can they too be impartial? And it's really this turning point during voir dire. And I think it has to do with being in the courtroom, which is a very formal setting, seeing people in their formal roles, hearing the legal language, and seeing the parties before them. And this is not, you know, a moment for comedy. It's not a moment for the films and the TV programs. And my theory is that every step that they will go through in the jury process will help them to realize that extraordinary behavior is required here. So yes, popular culture depicts it as something that is to be avoided. But when you step into that courtroom, things begin to change.
You know, this is, in terms of its relationship to popular culture and the media, this is a sui generis kind of experience we're having here. I mean, first of all, the defendant is not only a former president of the United States, he's a former pop culture star for 14 years on The Apprentice. At least one prospective juror has said, as a middle schooler, he watched The Apprentice and it had a big influence on him. There's also the way in which the jurors themselves are kind of getting turned into media figures, sometimes being described in a little too much detail on evening cable news programs. Jesse Waters in particular did that to a juror who I think was basically squeezed off the jury by that kind of courage, by that kind of coverage. And you know, they're even in late night television monologues. The person I talked about before who said she wouldn't trust anything Trump said, even if his tongue was notarized. Jimmy Kimmel quoted her and said she didn't get on the jury, but he might want to hire her as a writer. This is weird, right? There's a kind of the membranes that separate pop culture from news and reality are very blurred at this moment. So anything you want to say about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we have to keep in mind this is a high profile case, and that's very unusual. There are many jury trials, and they go on and, you know, they go through a lot of this, all the same processes as what we're seeing today. So we have to put this in perspective, that this is unusual in that it's high profile, but it will go through all the same procedures. And what will happen eventually is that you have some extra safeguards. And the judge, I think, is doing a good job of making use of them and trying to protect the jurors.
All right, we're going to reluctantly have to stop there. There's a lot of things to talk about here as this trial goes on. But Nancy Marta, thank you so very much. Professor of Law, Director of the Justice John Paul Stevens Jury Center and Co-Director of the Institute for Law and the Humanities at the Chicago Kent College Law at Illinois Tech. Author of The Power of the Jury, Transforming Citizens into Jurors.
I admire any guy who knows his stuff. Sure, we blew a couple ventures with the counterfeit debentures. But you win a few, you lose a few, like Bernie says, you keep on hanging tough. And thanks to you, my attorney Bernie, thanks to you, I'm considered well-to-do.
And we're back in time to thank certain people, including the maestro. That would be Dylan Reyes. He's our technical producer today. Lily Tyson is the senior producer of the Colin McEnroe Show and the producer of this episode. I am once again starstruck to introduce our final guest, simply because she's had a big impact on my teaching career. Vanessa Otero is the creator of the Media Bias Chart and the founder and CEO of Ad Fontes Media. I just want to say, I teach a political journalism class at Yale, and I've been doing this for a number of years. On the first day, one of the things we all look at together is Vanessa's chart, which takes the media and kind of ranks them on two axes. One of them is kind of the political lean, and the other axis is the level of reliability. So there are certain parts of the chart you really don't want to be on. So Vanessa Otero, welcome to our show.
Thank you so much for having me, Colin, and it warms my heart to hear you share that story of you sharing the chart with your class at the beginning of the semester.
Yeah, and we come back to it from time to time, and now you've got kind of subordinate versions, like there's just podcasts, which I found very useful too. So why did you make such a chart?
Well, it actually sort of came about as a hobby. I was practicing as a patent lawyer during the 2016 election. I was alarmed by the fact that folks would, especially on Facebook, they would fight about the news sources, about Hillary and Trump, really. They'd fight about politics and they exchange unreliable, really biased news sources with each other in an effort to convince each other. And they'd say, oh, Hillary's a devil. Look at this YouTube clip. And Trump is a racist. And look at this, HuffPost article. And failed to convince each other, not become friends. And it was alarming to me that people couldn't really tell that some news sources are better, some are okay, some are worse. It's not as simple as real or fake news. And there's some stuff that's left and right and center, and there's nothing wrong with that. But then there's stuff that's really out there on the fringes, and people seem to not be able to differentiate between those things. So it took a few weeks, created an infographic, and it went really viral on Facebook at first and Twitter, much to my surprise. And almost 8 years later, here I am, and I have a company that sort of revolves around that chart idea.
Yeah, and you have a lot of analysts now who do this, and the trial, the Trump trial right now, is kind of trying to mirror your work, or was last week during jury selection. Jurors were asked very specifically what kind of news media they consumed, and I'm wondering what you think about that effort. I mean, the news media that we consume may or may not say a lot about how we're going to behave on a jury or in other places. What was your take?
I thought it was fascinating and also insightful, because if you're trying to determine somebody's bias, like your news consumption can be really revelatory, because there are literally tens of thousands of news and information sources out there now, and that has not always been the case. A lot of folks remember times where there was three main network stations, your local paper, some national papers, and local public radio, and not a ton else. But now there's tens of thousands. So, and they're quite niche, and you can sort of choose your own reality, unfortunately. And if the kind of news media, like as you see on the infographic, the media bias chart, there are gradients of center, left, and right. It's not just like people feel like they know the really well-known news sources. Everyone knows, CNN, Fox, MSNBC, and kind of where they land on the media spectrum. But there are so many websites, so many podcasts that some of which are really fringe, some of which are really thoughtful and analytical. And being able to determine, not is somebody like fall into a binary, like are they a Trump voter or are they a Biden voter? We get forced into that binary by our electoral system, but that really usually doesn't reflect a person's true view of the world. So it's if somebody's reading, you know, middle of the road or, you know, center left, center right news media, and those are their primary news sources versus something really fringe, strong left to right or really fringe left to right, that will tell you a lot more about their actual political viewpoints.
You know, one of the things that's going to come out of this trial a lot, and in fact, the trial, as you and I are talking, is adjourned for the day. I believe that David Pecker was partway through his testimony at the time that it adjourned. But one of the things that will be kind of put on showcase here during this trial is, in fact, a kind of media that we don't think about in the same way we would think about the Washington Post or NPR or The Hill or whatever, and that is tabloid media. And one of the things that's come out already, Lachlan Cartwright writing about it in the New York Times Sunday Magazine, is what it was like to work at the National Enquirer, where not only were they catching and killing Trump stories, but they were, you know, putting big, huge headlines. Who's Chelsea's real dad? Prez hopeful Hillary's moment of truth, exclusive DNA test results bombshell, or Hillary 6 months to live. Cruel Bill forces her to stay on campaign trail. And then there'd be these kind of doctored photos of Hillary Clinton looking really sick. And, you know, from your point of view, that's an interesting thing. People see that stuff in the supermarket. We have no idea what kind of impact that kind of less well-documented form of tabloid journalism has on people.
Yeah, I mean, National Enquirer is a really unique one. I mean, it's sort of gone in and out of existence over the years since the, you know, the issues, the facts at issue in the case. But it was always one of our lowest reliability sources, and because a lot of and it was close to the middle. It was one of those unusual sources that was like bottom middle. Usually, don't see bottom middle anymore. You know, I don't know if you remember like the World Weekly News or something like that. It was another like magazine, like Black and White, the one with like Bat Boy and everything.
Yeah.
That was like sort of the original fake news, but it was so like over the top that it was like it seemed almost satirical. And a lot of there's not a lot of content, a lot of informational content, tabloid content like that that fills that that spot anymore, because even the National Enquirer in 2016 realized that, you know, there's audience to be gained by, in addition to having like celebrity crazy stuff that's, you know, not true, political crazy stuff, and they happen to find a home being the anti with the anti Hillary types of stories. So National Enquirer moved over to the right in our ratings during that time period. It's a unique one. Not that it doesn't exist. There's the tabloid newspapers, especially in the UK. Especially as it pertains to the royal family, we'll certainly dip into the not as political type of celebrity misleading, propagandistic, false information.
You know, we're almost out of time here, and I have like an hour's worth of questions for you. But one of the things that strikes me is it's called a media bias chart as opposed to a journalism bias chart, and I assume that's because increasingly there are questions about what counts as journalism. I mean, Pod Save America is a good example. I love this podcast. It's fascinating. It's funny. I get a lot of information out of it. It's not really journalism. It's a bunch of former Democratic political operatives kind of mapping out how they think campaigns should be run and stuff like that. But it is journalism in the sense that it sits somewhere in that ecosystem alongside journalism. But I'd love your thoughts about this.
Yeah, the terms news and journalism and media, they're really broad, and people think they have this definition in their heads of what to them qualifies as any one of those things. Media is sort of the broadest term, and we're not by any means saying that, you know, what's on this chart is journalism. We rate what we call news and news-like information, and that can include podcasts, because people do get information upon which they make life decisions, like how to vote, like what whether they should get a vaccine. You know, they make decisions based on all sorts of informational type of content. And our news landscape, I have a narrower definition of journalism. Our organization has a narrower definition, but you know, reliable fact reporting, like the work that journalists do to uncover new information, that's what we call journalism. But so much of our media landscape is that plus mix it in with analysis, mix it in with opinion. So, you know, podcasts, they might be bringing information to you, but usually it's not originally reported information. And often it's just with like Pod Save America, for example, a lot of opinions on what should or shouldn't happen, predictions on the future based on the facts. So we try to measure everything. That's what, you know, I certainly wouldn't call the stuff at the bottom of the media bias chart journalism, but people do consume it, so right. We rate it.
Beautifully put. We have to stop there. I've got lots more. We'll have to book some more time. But Vanessa Otero, thank you so much. The creator of the media bias chart and the founder and CEO at Ad Fontes Media. And thanks very much for listening today. We'll be back with more as the week rolls along.